Now at the festival, he tells us, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner from the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At that time they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. Now there's a problem in the text here. The scholars who translated the New Revised Standard Version and so on, they put the word Jesus in brackets. You mightn't find it in your Bible in many texts. But it was their opinion that probably Jesus is the original text, Jesus Barabbas, and that Jesus was dropped out in early manuscripts because it was too offensive to have Barabbas also called by the name Jesus. The data is that most of the early, that is, the 4th century texts don't have Jesus in, but some do. And we can't be sure whether Jesus was put in or taken out. Most probably taken out. So I've put it in there for you. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. Bar in Hebrew means, or Aramaic means, son. Abba, I think you know, means father. Barabbas, Jesus, son of the Father. Jesus, son of the Father. Powerful, again, coincidence, but certainly used here theologically by Matthew, because we're all Barabbas. We're all the sons, daughters, the sons of the Father, who are guilty, should be crucified, as it were, have done things to destroy our own life. And here's another innocent Jesus, Baraba, the son of the Father, who is crucified for us. Paul, he loved me and he gave himself for me, took my place. And so it's a beautiful picture and a beautiful theological truth. After they gathered, Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah? For he'd realized that it was out of jealousy that they handed him over. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, as Pilate's wife, have nothing to do with that innocent man, for today I've suffered a great deal because of a dream about him. In Matthew, dreams are a means of God revealing truth. Joseph, a number of times in a dream, was told what to do and who Mary was and where to go to Egypt and so on. And of course that's true, of course. But they were very conscious of dreams being a medium for revelation, which we would still know. But this woman has a dream about Jesus, and the dream, which is revealing God's will, is not to condemn him. Another fairly powerful and obvious statement about what God's will in all this was or was not. Anyhow, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus killed. The governor again said to them, which of the two do you want me to release for you? They said, Barabbas. Pilate said to them, then what should I do with Jesus who is called the Messiah? And all of them said, let him be crucified. And he said, why, what evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, let him be crucified. So when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, very powerful, the representative of the most powerful nation in the world saw that he could do nothing. What kind of power is this? The power is in the hands of the rabble, the crowd. But rather that a riot was beginning, took some water, and in another powerful image, washes his hands before the crowd, saying, I'm innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves. Then the people as a whole answered, his blood be on us and on our children. I'll come back on that in a moment. So he released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, handed him over to be crucified. His blood be on us and on our children. understand the meaning of that text, we've got to go back, of course, in the literature and see how was that used. And here's a couple of examples. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 9 reads, "All who curse father or mother shall be put to death." Primitive society with very rigid rules to keep it intact. Normal behaviour in societies at this level. "All who curse father and mother shall be put to death. Having cursed father or mother, their blood is upon them. If you kill them, it's not your responsibility, it's their responsibility for what they've done. It's on them, their head. They've got to wear responsibility for it." Second book of Samuel 1:16, a man comes in and tells David with great joy how he has killed Saul, who was the one whom David is going to replace. He thought David would be delighted. David said to him, "Your blood be on your head. For from your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I've killed the Lord's anointed." Jeremiah 26, not using the phrase, but having the idea, "Know for certain that if you put me to death, you will be bringing innocent blood upon yourselves and upon this city and its inhabitants. For in truth, the Lord sent me to you to speak all these words in your ears," says Jeremiah. And again, Jeremiah, "Jerusalem shall say, may my blood be avenged on the inhabitants of Chaldea." So blood means life. And the phrase, "His blood be on us and on our children," we take responsibility for the death of Jesus. Not you, Pilate. We will take it. It's on us. What did Matthew understand by that? Two things. One is the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70 AD, still in an most probably a terrible recent event as this gospel is emerging, seen as a result of this, not listening to the man of peace. The blood is on us and on our children, suffering for what we did here in this crowd. But I think, and this has got to be carefully said, I think there's another deeper. Well, I can see in it, and I won't, from a scholarly point of view, you couldn't do this, but there's other ways of looking at Scripture. I think, "His blood be on us and on our children." At the Last Supper, Jesus said, "This is my blood given for you for the forgiveness of sins." And though the meaning of the text is, as I've described, an acceptance of responsibility, is Matthew also praying that the blood of Jesus will be upon them to forgive? His blood be upon us. In another sense of God's love and life flowing over these people to bring about a healing and a forgiveness. I don't know, but I think it could be there. In chapter 27, verse 27, "Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him, put a scarlet robe on him, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed in his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews.' They spat on him, took the reed, struck him on the head, and after mocking him, stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him." So I'll leave you there, and we'll pick up man from Cyrene named Simon, and compelled this man to carry Jesus' cross. Another wonderful symbol. Why this is remembered and why it's put in is the point. We know from the letter to the Romans that there was a man called Simon there, and his two sons, Rufus and Alexander, were in the Roman community. It could be that that's the same Simon. I mean, there's no doubt family connections here. So there could be very personal reasons for it being mentioned and remembered in the community. Perhaps this man was so struck by what he did that he actually became a disciple. Not at all unlikely. But he is presented here, certainly, as the disciple. If you want to follow me, take up your cross daily and follow me. This man is compelled to carry the cross. Well, how many of us carry a cross in any other way? When I think of the crosses, the very few that I've had, some of them enormously heavy, I might add, but very few, I didn't want them. So you're compelled, life compels you to carry them. Starts as a compelling, some people embrace the cross, well, good, go for it if you want to. But most of us are compelled by age, sickness, breakdown of relationships or whatever it might be, to carry the cross. But when we start compelled in our life too sometimes, the grace works and the cross becomes redemptive. Well, that could have been what happened to this man, but he's a symbol of the disciple following Jesus on the road to Calvary. When they came to a place called Hebrew Golgotha, and Matthew translates, which means the place of a skull, and if you go into another translation, the Latin for place of a skull is Calvaria, hence Calvary. So that's where we get our Calvary from, this actual text, the place of the skull. Why it's called the place of the skull? Was a skull discovered there? Was it in the shape of an outcrop of rock that looked like a skull in this quarry just outside the wall where they'd quarried for rock and left a bit exposed and so on? Well, I don't think anyone knows. But at any rate, that's what this outside the wall, this outcrop of rock near a quarry was called the place of the skull. So they come there. They offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. It's a drug to help the person not suffer so much. When he tasted it, he would not drink it. Jesus, the point being that he chose to be there in the whole experience to the full and not to be deadened to it by the drug. There is a text in the book of Proverbs, chapter 31, verse 6 to 7, which may be playing underneath this text. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. No doubt a proverb, because that's the way people were treated or expected to be treated. When Jesus did not drink it, is that because he didn't consider that he was in misery? Is it also saying that he had a deeper purpose in this? That he was looking at the whole thing while experiencing it, all its terror, he was actually somewhere deeper than it in connection with the God and with a purpose that God would use this for. When they crucified Jesus, they divided his clothes among themselves by casting lots. I want to come back on that later. Then they sat down there to keep watch over him. Over his head they put the charge against him, and this was Roman custom. So they nailed a bit of paper or cardboard to the top of the T-cross. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. That's the reason for the crucifixion, a messianic claim or a rabble-rouser, however they understood it, the King of the Jews. Actually, just another bit of side information that might help you understand some things, in John's Gospel, it's slightly different. It's Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And if, once again, since Latin was the language of the Western church for centuries, right up till very recently. In Latin, that's Jesus is Jesus, it begins with an I, of Nazareth, Nazarenus, N, King, Rex, of the Jews, Judaeorum, I-N-R-I. You see it, don't you, often on the top of a crucifix? Well, that's this, Jesus, Jesus, Nazarenus, Rex, Judaeorum, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Here in Matthew, the word Nazareth is not included. And he tells us that two bandits saw, thieves, robbers, criminals, highwaymen, whatever, were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Jesus chose to live with sinners, and quite fittingly, he dies with them. He dies surrounded by the kind of people that he loves. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "You would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." We've gone right back to chapter 4 in Matthew, the temptations in the desert. If you are the Son of God, remember, make these stones into bread. If you are the Son of God, cast yourself down. Those temptations are, what does it mean to be the Son of God? And what it means to be the Son of God is to be the Son of Man. That's the gospel answer. The Son of God, the one in whom God's life is, the way to express that in human condition is to be a man, a woman, a human being who accepts the limitations of the human and identifies with the reality of the human condition, but identifies it while bringing to it the immense love of God. And love always means forgiveness, because we're not innocent. So that's what it means. So here, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. Of course Jesus can't come down from the cross. You try it. He's the Son of Man. He's not magician, and he's not Superman, and he's got nails in his wrists and you can't pull them out. You can't pull yourself off your cross either, and I can't get off mine. We're not like that. But look at that terrible thing they tell him to do. Save yourself. That's a very ironic statement here, because all through the Gospels, hasn't Jesus been saying, if you seek to save yourself, you will lose yourself. It's the one who loses, wastes, lets go of the self that will find it. I won't go into that again. We did it at great length back in chapter 16, but it's got to be subtly understood, and who of us really understands it? But it's got to be carefully read. But it does mean something about self-preservation is not the way to go. Self-discovery, yes. But the self is a flowing thing. It's a spring of living water that wells up and gives. It's got to be let go to be alive, otherwise it stagnates. Something like that. You can't save yourself. Jesus can only do what you and I can do. We can cry out to God to save us, but we can't save ourselves. And if we try to, it's foolish and it doesn't work. And here they are asking Jesus to do the very thing he said we're not allowed to do. We can't do. So if you're thinking of saving yourself, stop it and go and try and save someone else or something. But give love, and that'll release the logjam of the spring, and then life from God will come and it will save us. In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking Jesus and saying, he saved others, he can't save himself. Of course he can't. He's the King of Israel, let him come down from the cross now and we'll believe in him. And I, as a child, I remember quite distinctly, was given this horrible image by my teachers. Didn't do me much damage, I don't think, and you probably heard it too, but, you know, we had this awful image of Jesus that he could have come down but didn't because he loved us. That just mucks up the whole thing. If Jesus could come down from the cross and didn't, how does that help you who can't come down and don't? Like he couldn't come down on the cross any more than you and I can, because he's man. And the cross was, there were too many of them and they were too strong and the nails were too tough. So it's not a miracle that he didn't come down, it's an obvious fact. But if he comes down from the cross, we will believe in him. How stupid. What would they be believing in then? A magician? They can only believe in him by looking at him on the cross and seeing the way he prays, loves, forgives there. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he wants to. He said, I am God's son. That's the temptation again. You shall worship, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. So the proof that you're God's son and trust God is that God will deliver you. Does it mean that? Does God have to deliver me? Does God have to... Is it loving to deliver me from many crosses that I've got? How do I know? How do you know? God does deliver us ultimately, but only by going through it often, through the death into the resurrection. And according to Matthew, who hasn't that lovely story that's in Luke, the bandits who were crucified with him also taunted him in the same way. Everybody is laughing at Jesus. Everyone is missing the point. Nobody seems to be watching what's happening or alert to the reality